Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our next edition of Taking Stock. I apologize. It's been a few weeks since we've had the opportunity to connect, but really excited to welcome everyone back and to welcome Beth Ritter to our podcast today. I'm going to let Beth introduce herself. You'll hear her introduce herself. She has a fantastic background in the CPG industry. And as you'll hear, we're going to talk about a topic that is very top of mind and very much in the news right now, which is the broader topic of managing a diverse workforce. Hey, Beth, welcome to Taking Stock. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for inviting me for the conversation.
I am extremely appreciative that you're joining us. And I've mentioned this to you previously, but I think we're kind of like in the, you know, either 25 or 26 Taking Stock, and you are our first guest outside of the friendly confines of Clarkston. So I couldn't think of a better person to welcome to the podcast. Congrats on being the first outsider to join the discussion.
Thanks. Even more honored.
Yeah. Maybe we'll see how you feel in 15 minutes. But so you have a really, really cool background. And then for our listeners, I wanted to share a little bit about Beth and actually let Beth share a little bit about her background, because it's a pretty cool journey that you took in your career. And we've had the opportunity to work together side by side, working together with clients. And you've actually been a client of Clarkson's, and and we've had some a lot of fun working together through the years. But talk a little bit about your background. You know, you having served in industry first, so you've had a pretty extensive background in the CPG industry.
Yeah, so that pretty extensive is your way of saying I'm old, isn't it, Steve?
No, not at all.
No worries. But yeah, I did have a great long career in the consumer goods industry. I started at Nabisco when Nabisco was a standalone company, spent a lot of time really being the HR person for supply chains, but also have worked in the headquarters of the Nabisco businesses as well. Think Planner's Peanuts, think A1, Grey Poupon, those items. They're now owned by a different firm, but those were part of Nabisco then. And I left there and I went to the Campbell Soup Company and had a great global experience there. The toughest part of that job was they owned Godiva at the time, and I did have to taste the chocolate. It was tough. And then I got a call for a small consumer brand named Burt's Bees, and I left the Fortune 500 consumer goods firms and went to a private held entity. And it was a big shift, but really wonderful experience for me. So I led the HR function at Burt's Bees and was actually there when Burt's Bees was purchased by Clorox. Mm-hmm. And so I was involved in the transition then to make sure that that went smoothly for the brand. And then I thought, what am I going to do now? I don't know if I can find anything as cool as leading the HR function as Burt's Bees. So I decided to do something completely different. And I checked into all the universities and found that NC State had a great human resource program in their College of Business. So I am now an associate professor at NC State in the Poole College of Management. And what that means is I get to teach and research in all areas of talent management that I got to live in my first career. And it's worked out really well. I'm pleased to say that I've been here now for almost 9 years, which is hard to believe. And I really get to, you know, kind of do the things I enjoy and continue to learn and grow. And I get to, you know, consult with firms and offer them advice. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's so cool. Especially, I can't imagine a more fascinating time to be in this space teaching kind of young minds, because there's so much change going on in the market right now. We're going to talk about it a lot today. But my first question is, so NC State, Penn State, football, basketball, who are you pulling for? Because you essentially, you know, gave up on your Big Ten roots as a Penn State grad and shifted over to the ACC. So where does your allegiance lie?
Well, you know, it's It used to be pretty clean. When I first came down here, I didn't know anything about basketball because I was from Penn State. Many years ago, I came to North Carolina. They had to explain what the ACC was to me and sort of tell me about all those teams and things. No lie. I was working at a firm, and the big deal was they were going to have a TV in the break room, in the lunch room on the Friday day of the tournament. And I'm sort of like, what? So that was the easy way to kind of be true to both, is so I could sort of learn about basketball down here and then stay true to Penn State on the football side.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, let's dive in if we can. And one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot, and which I'm fascinated, if you think about the broad topic of managing a diverse workforce, right? It's and diversity could mean so many different things. We've talked about diversity a lot on this podcast, Beth, as it relates to inclusiveness and equity. But if we think just more kind of broadly around kind of just the demographics of the workforce and how those have changed, there's a few different areas that I wanted to dive into with you. The first is this idea of managing a hybrid workforce. And so much of this has been, like many other things, accelerated from COVID, right? With remote and on-site resources. There's not a day goes by you don't find an article from HBR or other sources just talking about how companies are potentially going to adjust to the future as it relates to finding that right mix, that right balance of remote work versus on-site work. Are we going to return back to the way things used to be? Have we come into a new normal? I guess at a high level, what are your thoughts around kind of the managing of a hybrid workforce? Where do you think we're heading? And then what are some of the challenges that come about in managing that hybrid workforce?
Good question. So the first thing I just think it's probably worth saying is this hybrid workforce is our new term for the year, right? That isn't right. Something we had heard of before now. And what I'm learning, you know, in conversations with lots of folks is that it seems to be landing on 3 days in the office and two remote mm-hmm. for a lot of firms. That's going to be their version of hybrid. And okay. 3 days may be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But even traditional manufacturing firms that really kind of surprised me are looking into this for their non-production line workers and setting up pretty intense policies and application processes right now, rather, to move to this hybrid or core working day system. Mm-hmm. So, and what I'm hearing is that people are pretty excited that it's going to open up lots of new doors for talent. You know, they're not going to be geography constrained anymore. Mm-hmm. And when I think about that new model and the complaints I hear when I talk with people, I think getting back to basics on job descriptions is going to be really important. And I know that kind of sounds like, I don't know, nerdy or I don't know, sure, you know what, you know, like what job descriptions, but if I say it this way, I think it'll make sense. I think for that process to work, sometimes in the office and sometimes not, you have to be really clear with expectations. Mm-hmm. A manager has to decide, what does success look like? And even more importantly, how am I going to measure it? And it's that measurement part that usually gets, throws people off, right? That gets a little harder. But I think that's what it's going to take then we opened this with talent management ideas. I think that's what it's going to take for managing is for people to get really clear about expectations and success.
So let me kind of dive into a couple of areas there. And I agree with everything you're saying. So I'm not challenging it, but I want to call out a couple of things that I think could be an issue. You mentioned
sure.
non-production employees So first, if you look at the delineation of a workforce within a traditional CPG, you're going to have your corporate and then you're going to have your more manufacturing or production-based employees. Are we creating a class system, and or is there potentially going to be animosity where there's you've got corporate employees who have the flexibility, and we've seen this through COVID, right?
Yeah.
Where you have corporate employees who have the flexibility to work Monday home, Friday home, in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, but you still have your production line workforce there every single day, you know, commuting 5 days a week, doing their, like, how do you manage that? And how do you ensure that you're not creating kind of a dual class system?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that topic's been going on for a long time, even before COVID and even before a hybrid workforce. My manufacturing employees at any of those companies I mentioned sort of always felt like there were some differences between, you know, the work conditions, if you will, for them versus others. And so I think it gets back to, again, what's the work you're doing? And so even if I'm, considered a salaried or exempt quality assurance professional, if my work means I'm attached to the line, I'm probably going to have a lot less flexibility. I'm going to be an essential worker, you know, which is what COVID taught us too. And I'm not going to be able to, you know, set up this core, you know, core hour process thing, you know, for myself. And so I think companies just have to get comfortable with the differences. And I think that's where transparency makes a lot of sense. And I think when you can tie things to business reasons, people usually accept that, you know, so if there's a business reason, the quality assurance person needs to be in the plant and the accountant maybe doesn't have to. Sure. And so I think that's what's critical is making sure choices are fair and tied to the real work. And then people can usually get it.
Yeah, like you said, it ties back to those job descriptions and the expectations.
Yeah.
The last question or point that I had around this hybrid workforce, I've read a lot recently as companies are slowly starting to return back to going to the office and set up new kind of policies to allow them to do that effectively. Those that might potentially be opting for a more remote schedule, because a lot of companies are leaving it up to the employee to determine, hey, come into the office when you want to come in. If you could get your work done remotely, great. Is there going to be opportunities afforded to those that are heading to the office every day? The informal opportunities, the ability to get FaceTime with higher ups in the office. Are they going to be have opportunity for promotion and advancement more so than those that are working remotely?
Steve,
how do you manage that?
Yeah, I think that's the reality. And that's one of those lessons we have, again, pre-COVID. We always, many firms have had what I refer to as a distributed workforce. And I'll use, you know, Clarkson as an example. You have a headquarters in North Carolina, but workers distributed throughout, you know, the U.S. And we've always, the larger you get as a firm, usually that's going to happen. And just like you said, the things happen in the headquarters location that are maybe different than other locations. And so I think in this new model, if a company is really going to embrace a hybrid workforce and, you know, really support the fact that people can work remotely and leverage that they can work remotely and hire somebody in a new location, you know, get that new talent, then I think they have to be really clear about who's involved in decision making. It's not just who's in the office. And that means, you know, if a customer issue flies up on Monday and that's not our core working day, we have to be disciplined to still, you know, get on Zoom and get the right people engaged in the process. And if companies don't do that, if leaders don't do that, that's where I think insecurities are going to come up and people are going to feel like I'm not getting visibility. I'm not included. And then, you know, they may leave, you know, they may go to a company that has embraced this real hybrid process. So I do think it's going to be a bit of a test that employees are going to watch how leaders handle this and see if some people get advantages or not by, you know, who chooses to be in the office or not. Mm-hmm. But if a company can set up a culture where that doesn't happen, they're going to be pretty successful having this distributed workforce.
Yeah. One of the things that I read, and this is somewhat of a tactical idea, but I really liked it, is when you have meetings, and let's say you've got, you know, 15 people in a meeting and seven of those are remote and eight of those are in the office, those eight people in the office, you know, take that meeting in your office, as opposed to meeting in a conference room. So you don't have this feeling for those that are calling in and remote that they're missing out on this collaborative experience and FaceTime that, you know, those in the office have. Again, somewhat of a tactical idea, but I think there are things that you could do too. And I think, like you said, making sure that meetings and decisions are being made, you know, with an equitable mindset, I think is critical.
I think that's a great idea. You know, I'll just, it made me smile and laugh as you said it. Many years ago, I was working in a scenario where I was the remote person and there were a lot of people meeting in a room, conference room somewhere, you know, and I ended up partnering with one of the participants that he would text me to help me read the room, because this was even, this was even before Zoom, right? We were on, you know, teleconference, just, you know, and so he would text me and he would be like, keep going. Yeah, they like it, or no, slow down. You're losing them, you know, or whatever. And that was huge. That was so helpful. So I like the idea that you said. It kind of does level the playing field. And I think that's what this is really about, is making sure that the remote worker still feels like they are treated equitably and still have, like, you know, the same standing as everyone else.
Totally. So I want to transition to another topic around the kind of cross-generational workforce. I read recently that, and I think we're probably living in it right now, that for the first time in history, we have five generations working side by side, right? So from our traditionalists who were born prior to 1946, we still have, you know, those within that generation contributing within the workforce all the way through generation 2020, those that were born after 1997. You've got baby boomers, Generation X, millennials, all kind of working together. That's an interesting opportunity for companies, right, to bring in perspectives, varying degrees of experience, varying degrees of approaching problem solving. I think it's a wonderful opportunity, but it also brings about many challenges, right? And so much of it always seems to focus on the millennials, which I don't quite understand, because I think each generation brings its, you know, unique perspectives and characteristics to bear. But talk a little bit about kind of your thoughts around companies, whether it's five generations, a smaller number. It is an issue, challenge, and opportunity for companies to think about how to manage across multiple generations. And I know you've done a good amount of research around it, particularly as it relates to kind of ageism, and we can hit upon that in a bit. Yeah. But what are some of your thoughts around the topic more broadly?
Well, the first thing that strikes me as you laid out that description is that you're actually, if you're hiring off campus, you're actually hiring Gen Z too.
Right.
So you have Gen Y and Gen Z that are coming in, and that's who's in my undergrad classes right now. I teach at the graduate and undergraduate level, but, mm-hmm. and the millennials are in my MBA, you know, my graduate level classes. And so the first thing that you have to realize is your Gen Z off campus hires, you only know them remotely. You have interviewed them remotely. You have worked with them remotely last summer, and you've now extended an offer to them to maybe start, you know, this summer or this fall after they graduate. That's a really odd thing, right? And so I do think as we, you know, the word I'm hearing is sort of re-enter, but as we do this re-entry thing, I think something about relationship building across those generations is going to be really important. Building this community, rebuilding the community is probably a good way to say it. So keep that in mind that they've gotten pretty comfortable with remote. They're anxious to not be remote for sure. I can tell you that having, you know, a bunch of seniors in my class right now who are, you know, 3 weeks away from graduation or whatever, but they only know you remotely. And so just think about that. That's a pretty powerful statement that way. And then the other thing you mentioned that I have been doing some research with my colleague into sort of what are employers doing in response to the aging workforce. And, you know, what we've learned is that the things you think you're doing for the millennials or the things, the new programs you implement that you think you're doing for the aging workforce are usually really good for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, so for example, we did some surveying and yes, an aging worker might prefer, shorter hours, flexibility in hours, but so do the millennials and so does Gen X, right? You know, so it's sort of, if you can think about how to build flexibility, shorter hours, now this whole new remote hybrid work in, if your organization can do that well, that's going to work across all those generations. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, that's like what I said so much, and I'll let you certainly continue, but just to build upon that, we tend to label different generations. And, you know, again, I've seen this particularly around millennials, and they get typecast in a way that it really, some of the same characteristics exist across all generations. And I think that's exactly what you're referring to here. So I'll let you continue.
Well, I was just going to say you know, like companies, we've seen companies are doing things like financial planning. And that works for everybody too, right? And so you might think at first blush, well, let me put all the, you know, 55 and up in a room, and then, you know, they talk to the financial planner about their horizon, and then let's put all the millennials in a different room and they talk to it. But actually, I found it really powerful when we, you know, one of my environments was pretty small. We really couldn't necessarily afford to break it out into different slices like that. So we just put everybody in the room. And, you know, this really nice connection formed in there when the older worker kind of turns to the younger worker and says, you need to start saving sooner than I did. Learn right. from my mistake, you know, or this stuff is really important. Pay attention, you know, or whatever, right? So, you know, you don't, like you said, you don't always have to separate the groups, and actually the community part again, to get, you know, bringing people together, I think is important.
Yeah. I think the, whether it's training, professional development, or some, you know, some of the sessions that you're referencing, I think we are better off when we embrace our differences and we try to learn from one another. I love the idea of having kind of learners and teachers together. I like cross-generational kind of learning. I think there's so much to be learned from one another. You know, one of the things that we've talked about is, you know, when you have this kind of cross-generational workforce, you're going to have varying degrees of capabilities and interests and passions and skill sets. The more that you're able to blend that together, you know, those that, you know, have a digital mindset versus those that have a non-digital mindset, those who are very analytical versus those that are non-analytical, those that, you know, grew up in urban communities versus those that grew up in rural communities, those that went to higher college, you know, institutions versus those that did, like, the more they're able to blend that together, we're going to be better off. And organizations are going to, you know, the ideation process is going to be more effective. Problem solving is going to be more effective. We're going to be better off.
So the HR jargon for that is reverse mentoring, Steve. That would be the term, right? And I have a funny example to share. I just spoke with a group of leaders, and they were talking about having these informal board of directors or board of advisors. Mm-hmm. And one of them, pretty senior person, said, you know, I have started always having an intern as part of my informal board of advisors. And I laughed. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, they keep me current and relevant and, you know, like She said, yeah, I have, you know, other CEOs and I have an intern on my board of advisors too. And just to, you know, thought it reinforced your point there.
I love it. Or, you know, said more plainly, making sure that you have one foot planted in the real world in a lot of ways. Beth, this was awesome. I think we could talk forever, but I really enjoy your perspective. And I appreciate you correcting me and making sure I've got the right HR jargon. but really enjoyed your perspective on all of these topics. And would love to have you come back and talk more anytime.
Sure thing. I enjoyed it too, Steve.
All right. Thanks. We'll talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And Beth, thank you very much for being our first non-Clarkston guest on Taking Stock. Looking forward to having many more in the very near future. So really enjoyed the conversation with Beth. I always enjoy the opportunity to learn from her. I think she's got wonderful background and perspective, in particular around this topic of managing a diverse workforce. One of the things that we didn't hit upon, but I had done some research that, you know, alluded to the fact that almost half of remote workers say that they're really nervous about job security if they stay remote while their colleagues return to the office. I know we hit upon that a bit, not only around advancement, but also around job security. And then also, what does that mean in terms of potentially people hopping to new employers? Are we, with a lack of FaceTime, a lack of opportunity for people to interact with people outside of their core teams, is that going to lead to, you know, perhaps a culture decay that might lead people to more proactively and aggressively pursue options to pursue new employment? All things to keep our eye on. If you are leading an organization, I think these are all critical things for you to keep top of mind, especially as we transition back, hopefully in the very near future, to more traditional ways of working. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, looking forward to future conversations here on Taking Stock, and we'll see y'all soon. Have a great day.